This is the last of the historical books. You had the first five books of the Bible, which was the law, Genesis through Deuteronomy. And then you had the historical books, which are Joshua through Esther. And so as we take a look at this timeline, it just gives us the returns from the Babylonian captivity. The far left of the screen, you have the children of Israel going into captivity, and that was three waves under the Babylonians in 606, 597, and 586. And you can see the prophets that were taken into captivity at that time, too. Daniel was taken in 606, the prophet Ezekiel in 597, and then in 586, the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was destroyed. And then we had the first of the three returns, the first one under Zerubbabel, and that was recorded in the book of Ezra. So when we started the book of Ezra, that's what we started with, is that decree that Cyrus the Persian gave to allow the Jews to initially come back into their land. And what they did is they built the temple. It took about 20 years, but they rebuilt the temple. And then we're introduced to Ezra in the book of Ezra at about chapter 7, but that's well down the road. And what we have in the book of Ezra between chapters 6 and 7 is actually a time gap, and that's where the book of Esther, or the events that take place in the book of Esther, actually happen. So from a chronological standpoint, even though we're at the last book, as far as the Bible books go, of the historical books, we're actually back a few decades looking at the story of Esther. So in your mind, think of Zerubbabel has already brought 50,000 of the Jews back into the land. They've rebuilt the temple. And now over in Persia, what we're going to read about tonight in the book of Esther, these events are taking place. And then after that, Ezra will come back into the land, restore the people. And after him, Nehemiah came back. And Nehemiah is the one that rebuilt the defenses of Jerusalem. That would be the walls and also the city of Jerusalem itself. And so Nehemiah, what we read last week, is actually the end of the historical events that the Old Testament record from a chronological standpoint. But Esther is the last book as far as the historical books go, which means next week we're going to start the book of Job. So we'll be looking at the poetry books in the Bible, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Then we'll do the major and minor prophets and then on into the New Testament. And so that's where we're headed right now. Now, the book of Esther is the story of a Jewish girl who becomes queen of Persia and saves her people from annihilation. Now, the key players in the book of Esther is King Ahasuerus, who is the Persian king during this time, and his queen Vashti. Now, Vashti, we're going to see in chapter 1, becomes disobedient to the king, and so the king dethrones her and starts having a beauty contest to look for a replacement for the queen. And this is where Esther comes into play. She's chosen as the replacement. She is Jewish. Her cousin Mordecai is Jewish as well. And Mordecai raised Esther because Esther's mom and dad had died. And so he's an older cousin. And so he has raised her like his own daughter. And so she has become queen and he is concerned. And so he's outside of the palace wondering how she's doing and all. And then there is a Persian official named Haman, who doesn't get along with Mordecai, and he ends up wanting to completely annihilate the entire Jewish race because he doesn't like Mordecai, the Jew. And so Esther is in a position to save her people, and that's kind of the story in a nutshell. Now, in the book of Esther, a couple of interesting things. One is that the name of God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. His personal name, Yahweh or Jehovah, which is often as Lord, all caps in our Old Testament, never mentioned in the book of Esther. And the title God is never mentioned as well. So you never see God's personal name or the title God, yet you see the providence of God all through the book of Esther. In other words, you see him positioning people in the book of Esther so that the Jewish people are saved from annihilation. And so the hand of God seen all through it. I was looking through the Old Testament and ran a search on God's personal name, and it came up in every single one of the Old Testament books except Esther, except the book of Ecclesiastes, and except the book of the Song of Solomon. So those are the three books in the Old Testament that didn't have the name Yahweh in it. The book of Ecclesiastes had the title God throughout it. Song of Solomon actually had a compound name of God. And so it's the word, I think, for flame and the contraction of God's personal name, Yah. So I think it's translated a vehement flame, and I think it's Song of Solomon 8:6. And so I guess they would count that as the name of God being in the Song of Solomon, the title of God in Ecclesiastes, and then throughout the rest of the Old Testament in every book except the book of Esther. So that's one of the interesting features about the book of Esther. The other thing is that in the book of Esther, the story that I just mentioned is the background for the Jewish feast of Purim. And we're going to be looking at that a little bit. And this is a celebration of the deliverance, the salvation of the Jews from Haman and his desire to completely annihilate them. It's a feast that they keep today in our February and March, their month Adar. And so that's a feast, one of those that have continued, that we see the background, not a mandate that they have a feast, but by God anyway, but a feast that is celebrating the deliverance that we're going to read about in this book right here. So here in chapter 1, what we've got going is King Ahasuerus has called together many of his leading officials, and historians tell us that this is at the time frame where he is going to attack Greece. And so he's got, and again, he's the king not just of a city, but he's the king of the Persian Empire. So he has a lot of leaders throughout his empire, and he's called them into Shushan, the capital of Persia. And it's believed that they're going over their strategy for the military campaign that's coming up, and they're there for 180 days. They're there for half a year. And at the end of that, there's a seven-day feast. And so it's during that feast where they're drinking wine that he calls for the queen. So this is kind of the background or where we're going here in chapter 1. So let's just jump right in. Esther, chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This was the Ahasuerus who reigned over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And so, like I mentioned, it's believed that these first 6 months were actually a strategic military planning time for a attack against Greece, as historians tell us, and then this seven-day feast that they had at the close of that. Now, while he's feasting with his lords, as the chapter goes on, we find that Queen Vashti is also having a feast with the female guests that are there in Shushan as well. In verse 10, we see the king calling for the queen. It says in verse 10, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abaktha, Zether, and Carcass, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. And so, again, when his heart is merry with wine, I think we all can understand what that means. At the seventh day of the feast, he goes, you know, call for my babe to come in here and be paraded in front of all these guys. And she basically said, I ain't doing it. I ain't coming in. Well, this made the king, as we just read, furious. But it also made the other guys really nervous. Because if the queen can get away with disobeying the king, what's all their wives going to do to them? And what message is that going to send throughout the Persian Empire? And so the officials persuade the king to dethrone Vashti. You know, you've got to set her, you've got to make an example out of her so that all of our wives will submit to us. And so they encourage him to do that. He follows with it. He writes a decree. He sends it throughout the provinces so that everyone will know that the queen has been dethroned because of her disobedience. If you jump to the last verse of chapter 1, verse 22, it says, "Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people." So this would encourage, they felt, submission if he made an example of Queen Vashti. Now, I think you can bludgeon people into submission, but I think a better way is to earn a person's respect. And when it comes to a marriage, I think that's the best way for things to work out. When you're the kind of guy that loves your wife and your wife loves to respect or submit to you because she knows that you have her best interests at heart, and it just seems to work a whole lot better that way. Well, chapter 2, we start having the beauty contest, and a replacement is sought for Queen Vashti. Chapter 2, verse 1, "After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti.' This thing pleased the king, and he did so." And so you've got an empire-wide beauty search that's going on to replace the queen, and the king goes, "You know, I think that's a good idea. Let's do that." So verse 5, "In Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish," notice, "a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away." That was the 597 deportation. "And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah," her Jewish name, that is Esther, her Persian name, "his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter." Now, notice we're introduced to Mordecai and introduced to his cousin Hadassah, which means myrtle, or Esther, which means star. They're descendants from the tribe of Benjamin. I just bring that out because I think it kind of plays in a little bit later. The first king of Israel was from the tribe of Benjamin, and that was King Saul. So these guys are from the same tribe. And so Mordecai is over there because of their ancestors were taken in the second deportation, and they're there in Shushan now, and Hadassah is very beautiful, and so she becomes one that is taken as a potential replacement for the queen. And so Mordecai gives her some strict orders to keep her nationality a secret, to not let them know that she is in fact Jewish. Verse 10, "Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her." So you could see the concern that Mordecai had for Esther. I mean, this was just like his daughter that he'd brought up, and now she has been taken from him to be brought up in preparation to meet the king. And they went through 12 months of beauty treatments. So 12 months in preparation to go before the king. And when it was Esther's time to go before the king, she was the one that was chosen. She was the one that the king liked the best. Verse 17 of chapter 2, "The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the Feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. And so as the story is unfolding here, we see that the queen has been replaced. Esther is the one who is now queen. Jewish, hidden, but queen over Persia. Now, the next bit of chapter 2 is significant. It's a significant part of the story down the road a little bit. In verse 21, it says, "In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." And so it's just a little piece of information that's going to come into play as we get further into the story. Here's Mordecai. He's outside the palace. He hears these two eunuchs saying, "We're going to take out," or whatever they were going to do, "to King Ahasuerus." He tells Esther. Esther tells the king. The king inquires. They find it's true. The two guys are hung. And then it's written down in the Chronicles. There's a record of Mordecai informing the king for the king's safety. We come into chapter 3, and we're now introduced to this Persian official named Haman. Chapter 3, "After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, 'Why do you transgress the king's command?' Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai." And so now we're introduced to this Persian official, Haman, whom the king had elevated to the point of the respect of the other people that were there. Now, we're told where Haman comes from. He's the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. And scholars debate as to what exactly that means. Is he a man that's from the city of Agag in Persia? So he's Haman the Agagite from Agag. Or is he a descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites? And if that's the case, it makes the story all the more interesting, because the Amalekites were to be utterly exterminated. They were perennial enemies of the Jewish people. They were on the heels of those coming out of Egypt, and they were knocking off the stragglers. And so God said, "You're always going to have the Amalekites at your heels. You need to take them out." And so if you remember in 1 Samuel 15, Samuel told King Saul, the first king of Israel, to go and utterly exterminate the Amalekites. And you remember King Saul went, and he attacked the Amalekites, but he kept the best of the spoil, and he also kept the king as his trophy, the king's name being Agag. And so if this man is a descendant of King Agag, he now is wanting to exterminate the Jewish people, whereas if King Saul had exterminated the Amalekites, this man wouldn't even be around. And to add to the story, remember that Mordecai and Esther are from the tribe of Benjamin, and they're going to be the ones that come in and save the day and the reason that Haman goes down. So if in fact that's the case, it adds a lot of color to the story. Now, as I mentioned, God's name isn't mentioned in the book of Esther. The title of God isn't mentioned, but I think you see elements of their Jewish faith in this. Why wouldn't Mordecai bow? Why wouldn't he pay homage? Is there a reason personally, or is it because, as it said, because he's a Jew? What does that mean? Well, if you're a Jew, you're not going to bow down to anyone but the Lord. And so I think there is there's these implications as we go through the book that point to their faith in God, even though God, for some reason, is not mentioned within the book itself. And so here we are in chapter 3, introduced to Haman. In verse 7, it says, "In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur," that is the lot, "before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar." What they were doing is casting lots, and the Persian word for lot is the word pur. And that obviously comes in to play when you have the naming of the feast of Purim. And so they were basically throwing the dice to say, when should we go out and kill all the Jewish people and wipe this nation off the face of the earth? And so as they cast lots, or threw the dice, so to speak, it came up to the month Adar, which is the 12th month. Now, here's a graphic of the Hebrew calendar alongside our calendar today, so you can get an idea as to where their months line up with our months. And so this is the month Nisan right now in the story. That's the first month. Notice the lot that was cast came up to the 12th month, the month Adar. Again, I think the providence of God is there, because now the Jews have a full year to figure out what they're going to do, instead of it being just a week or two down the road that they're going to wipe everybody out. With this calendar, you can see in Nisan, their first month, it's also the Feast of the Jews. You had Passover and unleavened bread, and then you come to the third month, you have the Feast of Pentecost. Come down to the seventh month, the month of Tishri, you have the Feast of Trumpets, and then Yom Kippur, the Feast of Atonement, and then the Feast of Tabernacles. You come up to Kislev, which is our December, and you have Hanukkah, which is when Hanukkah is celebrated. And then you come to Adar, which is our February, March, where the Feast of Purim is, which is a celebration of the Jews' deliverance from this decree that's going to go forth to annihilate all the Jews, a feast that they continue to celebrate today. Okay? And so it's derived from the word pur, which means lot. And because he cast lots to know the day and the month that they would go and they would attack the Jewish people. And so Haman goes to the king and explains that there is a people there that don't obey his laws. And so he asks if a decree can be made where all these people can be annihilated. Verse 10, "So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews." And basically what he was saying is, here is my signature, write the decree, and whatever you want to do, it will be done. The signet ring would be a ring that had some kind of a mold on it, or an impression on it. A carving on it, that when you wrote the decree and you put the blob of wax and you put your signet ring in it, it would leave that impression so the people would know this is actually from the king. So you could see it was like the king's signature. And so the king is basically giving the approval to Haman to do whatever you want, write whatever decree you want. You want to annihilate the Jews? Well, here's my ring. Go ahead, write up the decree, stamp it with my ring, and we'll get word sent out throughout the land. And so that's exactly what he does. He sends a decree again throughout the empire of Persia to all the provinces. Jump down to verse 15 of chapter 3. "The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed." So you get the concept of where their mind's at. Yeah, we're going to wipe out this whole group of people, this whole race of people. Let's have a drink. Let's sit down and have a drink while the rest of the city is in confusion. And so you have it broadcast throughout the empire. You have it broadcast here in the capital of the empire in Shushan, and the people do not know what's going on. Well, word obviously comes to Mordecai, and Mordecai, I mean, think about it. He is the reason. You think about it. He is the reason that the entire Jewish race now is set up for annihilation. So there's got to be a heavy load that he's carrying right here, as well as knowing that his life is on the line. So chapter 4, verse 1, "When Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry, He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. What are we going to do? We've got big trouble on our hands. So Mordecai is in sackcloth and ashes and mourning over this. Word gets to Esther what's happening with Mordecai. She sends word to say, why are you so upset? This is all through messengers. He sends word back to say, they've put a decree out where they're going to wipe all of us off the face of the earth. You need to go into the king and do whatever you can to persuade him to change whatever he can change so that we can protect ourselves or so that we can be safe. And Esther sends word back and says, look, nobody can go before the king unless the king summons him. It's unlawful just to walk in to his chambers. And I haven't been summoned for 30 days. And Mordecai sends word back and basically is saying, we are in trouble and you need to go. Chapter 4, verse 13. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? There's that classic passage in the book of Esther. You know, as Mordecai is saying, don't think that you're going to escape. I mean, you're in the palace, but you're Jewish too. And see, it's not the kind of thing where the king could just go, oh, wait, this is my queen. You're not going to kill her. No, if a decree has gone out that all the Jews will be annihilated, then all the Jews will be annihilated. It was the law of the Medes and the Persians. It was something that even the king couldn't change. That's why in the book of Daniel, chapter 6, the story of Daniel in the lion's den, and where the other leaders wanted to get at Daniel, and so they had the king say a decree, whoever prays to anybody but you, O king, let him be thrown into the den of lions. And so it was a law passed by the Medes and the Persians. And so when they came back and said, well, Daniel is praying to his God, the king couldn't undo it. The king had to let it go to pass or have it come to pass. And so all the king could do really is pray for Daniel that everything would be okay, which it was. So that's the deal that's going on now. A decree has been made that cannot be reversed, even by the king. And so Mordecai is saying to Esther, don't think you're going to be able to hide in the palace and you're going to be okay. And then he makes this profound statement of faith that deliverance will come from another quarter. I mean, he's got faith that we're going to make it through this. But who knows, you know, if you haven't been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this, for you to have the opportunity, maybe God has positioned you at this time, in this place, for this particular thing to be able to bring deliverance. And of course, how does that translate to us? We're all given certain opportunities, aren't we? And who knows that God hasn't placed us in certain positions so that we can do what he wants us to do. We have a choice. We can either step out in faith or we can shrink back in fear. Now, Esther had all the reason to shrink back in fear, didn't she? Nobody can go before the king unless he summons her. And so she could easily shrink back in fear. But if she did, then she wouldn't be used. If she stepped out in faith, then God could use her in a way to bring deliverance, which I believe he did. In Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 and 16, it says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. The exhortation, see then that you walk circumspectly. See then that you walk carefully in wisdom, redeeming the time. What that literally means is time is passing us all by. You know, it's coming and it's going, isn't it? It's to buy up. It's to buy up every opportunity that might come your way. So as you take advantage of those opportunities, you can do and be used the way God wants to use you. Or you can just let those go by, is the idea. Redeeming the time. Why? Because the days are evil. Because there are the Hamans out there that want to exterminate the Jewish people, God's people. We live in a day where it's time to stand up and do something, isn't it? To take advantage of those opportunities, whatever they might be, to be used by the Lord. And so who knows that you've come to the kingdom maybe for such a time as this. Verse 15, then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Now, why would she ask them to fast? I mean, when you think of fasting, what do you think of? You think of beseeching the Lord, right? Fasting and prayer. And so again, even though God's not mentioned in the book, can you see how the religion is there? It's kind of implied as we look through this. Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. I like her attitude. I'm going to do this. If I die, I die. But it's what I've got to do. It's what I've been called to do. It reminds me of the Apostle Paul. He's on his last journey. He's heading to Jerusalem. The prophets come up to him and say, you know what? Chains await you in Jerusalem. And his response was, oh, I shouldn't go. No, his response wasn't that at all. He has come into this ministry to preach the gospel. And if he's going to be persecuted, that's simply the way it is. Acts 20, verse 24, Paul said, none of these things move me, nor do I count my life dearer to myself so that I may finish my race with joy and the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus to testify to the gospel of the grace of God. He was saying, this is what my life is all about. It's running this race of preaching the gospel. This is the ministry that God has given me. And if chains await me in Jerusalem, if death awaits me, if I perish, I perish. It's what he's called me to do. And so the kind of faith that these folks have as they serve the Lord. Now, Queen Esther does go before the king. Chapter 5. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on the royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. So it was when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court that she found favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter. So far, so good, right? Everything's okay. I see her there. The golden scepter is held out so that she can come. Verse 3, and the king said to her, what do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom. So Esther answered, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Now recognize, she knows Haman is the reason behind all of this. That's got to be a scary spot to be in for her. Okay, she's not just going to the king saying, look, they want to annihilate us. She's going before the king and Haman saying, he is the one that wants to annihilate all of us. That must have been a scary thing for Esther to be in. Verse 6, at the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done. Then Esther answered and said, my petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. I don't know the reason for the delay. I don't know if it's like, you know, when you called your soon-to-be girlfriend or wife the first time to ask her out for that first date, and it came down to the last number on the phone to punch. You're like, you know what I mean? Maybe tomorrow. Maybe I'll do this another time, you know, because there's such a fear that comes in. And maybe that's part of it. Or maybe it was just the delay that was needed. Because with this delay, to put it off a day, remember that little thing that was written in the Chronicles where Mordecai had saved the king because of those two eunuchs that wanted to kill the king? Well, that's going to come into play here shortly. And so maybe that's the reason for the delay. It obviously worked out to that end. So, verse 9, so Haman went out that day, joyful, with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, besides Queen Esther, invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I'm going, invited by her along with the king. It's a proverb. Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. You see the arrogance in this. Well, he's about ready to go down. Verse 13, yet all this, he says, avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. He really has everything going for him, doesn't he? When you think about it, he is a top official. He is honored by the king. He's honored by his fellow soldiers and officers. And now the queen has invited only him along with the king to come. And so he's got a lot of good going for him. But as he says here, all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Isn't that true in our lives too? We can have everything's just going great and we can have that one thing that's going wrong. And isn't it true that it overshadows everything else in our lives? One little thing sometimes can just blot out all the good that's going on. That's why I think it's important sometimes to just stop and, like that song says, to count your blessings and just reflect upon all the good that God has done and is doing in our life. It really can change. It really can change our perspective on things. Verse 14, then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Now, this is his wife suggesting this. Kill the guy and then go happily to the banquet. I mean, who would want to marry somebody like this? Somebody who's like that. And that's how Haman is, isn't it? I mean, they're two peas in a pod when you look at it. So he has this gallows built 50 cubits, what is that, 75 feet tall. That night, the king could not sleep. Chapter 6, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. I can't sleep, bring me a boring book to read. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So again, I mean, isn't this just so providential, the providence of God, and just bringing this at this moment to say, Mordecai, well, has he ever been rewarded? No, nothing's ever been done for him. And so that's where the king's mind is right now. Well, mourning is upon us. Verse 4. So the king said, who is in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servants said to him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now, Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman answered the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on his head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And you just see the king going, that's a great idea. All right, that's a great idea, Haman. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. I bet the tone was a little bit different. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. Man, this has got to be the worst of the worst days for him. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall is of Jewish descent. You will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. And again, this is his wife. You're going down. While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, and on the second day at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom, it shall be done." Then Queen Esther answered and said, "If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing?" Now you got to imagine that Haman is just shaken in his boots at this point, you know. And notice how she phrases it. She says, "If it had just been that we were being sold as slaves, I wouldn't even have brought it up to you, you know, even though it would have been your loss. But because they want to kill me and my people, this is my request. And so who is it?" Verse 6. And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Now, at the Feast of Purim each year, they read the book of Esther. And whenever Haman's name is mentioned, everybody stomps their feet and they hiss. Shh. So as they're reading through this, that's what they would do today. So Haman is terrified. Verse 7, "Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden." Now, it might be, and I, you know, just kind of try to throw myself in the story. This is the king's right-hand man. And so it's not just like he's some eunuch of the harem or something. Oh, he's going to be put to death. But this is his right-hand man. And so maybe that's why he goes out into the garden to, I mean, he's infuriated, but man, this is my guy here that I've given my signet ring to. And maybe he goes out for that reason. I don't know. So he goes into the palace garden, but Haman stood, verse 7, before Queen Esther, pleading for his life. For he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. When the king returned from the palace garden to the palace of the banquet of wine, to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, "Will he also assault the queen while I am in the house?" As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath subsided. I don't know if it's poetic justice, biblically, you reap what you sow, or what we might say, what goes around comes around. I mean, it got him. And so Haman is out of the picture. And now Queen Esther is able to communicate that to the king. Mordecai is brought into the story. But that decree is still out there. It's a decree of the Medes and the Persians, and it can't be annulled. And so they have to do something to keep on that day of Adar all of the Jews being annihilated. So this is still an issue, even though Haman has been killed. Chapter 8, "On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. So the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman." And so Mordecai now is in this place. Esther again intercedes for her people, and what the king is able to do is he's able to have a new decree written that will allow the Jews to protect themselves. And so the decree has gone out. Everybody in the empire can attack and annihilate the Jews and take their possessions. But now a second decree has gone out that the Jews lawfully can protect themselves. And so that's how they handle this situation of not being able to retract that former law. And so the king writes a new decree where they can protect themselves. And the decree is written. It's distributed. Mordecai has been elevated to this great position within the city of Shushan. Jump down to verse 15. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. They rejoiced. Why? Because Mordecai had been elevated, and he is one of the rulers now in the city. In Proverbs 29, verse 2, it says, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when a wicked man rules, the people groan." As it was true then, so it is true today. When you get a righteous person that is reigning, now, admittedly, in our nation, not everybody is going to like that. But when you get a righteous person that is reigning, I mean, people rejoice because God has really set the standards. You know, he's set the standards for fair and just government. That's what our government is based on, is the truths that we find in the Word of God. That's how our forefathers set it up. But when you have a wicked man that's in authority, the people groan because of it, because of the things that take place. So here Mordecai is elevated. And interesting thing that took place, look at the last verse of chapter 8, verse 17. It says, "And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came that the Jews could defend themselves, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them." Now, what does that mean, that they became Jews? I mean, obviously, they can't change who their ancestors were. What does that mean, they became Jews? They proselytized into the Jewish faith, right? I mean, wouldn't that what it would mean to become a Jew? So again, even though God isn't mentioned, you can still see the faith of the Jewish people in between the lines, you might say, okay? And so you've got a lot of people because, you know, they don't want to see the Jews wiped out anyway, but they've, in reality, they've proselytized into that faith. It's so ironic because Haman wanted to exterminate them. What has it resulted in? It's resulted in more people becoming Jews because of it. Well, in chapter 9, we have the Jews, the 12th month coming, and the Jews able to defend themselves. Chapter 9, verse 1. "Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, the opposite occurred, in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them." And as you go throughout chapter 9, you find out that on that day, the 13th day, they had wiped out, well overpowered their enemies. The queen went back before the king, and the king said, "What do you want, Esther? I'll do whatever you want me to do." And she said, "Let them fight another day." And so it wasn't just the 13th of Adar, but also the 14th, and this is just in Shushan now, the capital, because obviously word cannot get to the rest of the empire in such a short period of time. And so throughout the empire, on the 13th, the Jews defend themselves, they're victorious. On the 13th and the 14th in Shushan, the Jews defend themselves, they're victorious. 75,000 people died through that, through them defending themselves. The ones that were attacking ended up dying. 10 sons of Haman were killed, and they were hung as well. And then we read in verse 20 that they decreed a feast day that would be observed to observe. See, they fought on the 13th and the 14th. They're going to observe the 14th and the 15th as days of celebration or deliverance, because on the 14th, the whole empire had deliverance. 14th and 15th, after the 2 days of fighting for Shushan. And so it's the 14th and the 15th of the month that they decreed to be the days that they would celebrate this feast. Chapter 9, verse 20. "And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews near and far who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar as the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending presents to one another and gifts to the poor." So the Jews accepted the custom which they had begun, as Mordecai had written to them, because Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to annihilate them and had cast Pur, that is, the lot, to consume them and destroy them. But when Esther came before the king, he commanded by letter that this wicked plot which Haman had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. And so the background for the Feast of Purim that is still celebrated today, where the Jews had victory over their enemies. Chapter 10, and King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and on the islands of the sea. Now all the acts of his power and his might and the account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second to King Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen. So he's elevated to the second most powerful man, the Empire of Persia. It's reminiscent, isn't it, of Joseph, who is elevated to the second most powerful man, second to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, in his days. And so it's a very similar story that you have here, a similar elevation, how this man was used. What is the moral of the story? What's the main theme or application that we walk away with? I think personally, when you have an opportunity, don't let it go by. You might have an opportunity, like Esther did, to completely change the course of history, to save her people. And we have opportunities, guys, that come about every single day. And we want to, as that scripture said, we want to make the most of them. We want to redeem the time because the days are evil. So let's keep that thought as we go throughout the rest of the week and as we read ahead for next week, the book of Job. All right, let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for the time that we could spend in your word tonight. And as we've been going through, as we close up this historical section of the Old Testament, we thank you that we have this history, that we might learn by it, that we might gain a warning from it, so that we wouldn't follow in the same steps that led to a lot of hurt and heartache and judgment. But help us follow those positive examples like we saw here tonight, that we might be used by you in a wonderful and a great way, and that we might make a difference in the lives of those around us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.